Hi, this is Bob Fitragis bringing you the other side of the news. I'm here with Tom Lindsay with the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund and Tish O'Dell with the Ohio Community Bill of Rights. We'll be taking a look today, reflecting, dialoguing on the question of community civil disobedience in the name of sustainability. That is the rise of the community rights movement in the United States. And again, there's a new publication out. I don't know how new it is, but first time I'm seeing it. And the question is, what can people do? And whether or not our system allows for sustainability. Tom, some would think of that as a provocative statement. I, on the other hand, as a political science a scientist, am in totally agreement with you. Our Constitution appears to be written for capitalism and a certain type of very kind of violent, in many ways, capitalism, at least to the environment, and a non-sustainable form of consumption. Is that your thesis?
Yeah. So, Bob, thanks, first of all, for having us on the show. The our work as the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund has basically been about assisting communities across the United States who are hit with different corporate projects coming into their community, like frack wastewater injection wells or frack wells or pipelines and those types of things. So corporations coming in to propose certain projects in their communities, and a lot of communities think that we live in a democracy and that in a democracy you should be able to say no to these projects coming in. Unfortunately, it's those same people in those communities who learn very quickly that the law is really on the side of the corporation putting the project in rather than on the side of the community trying to stop it. And so this, you know, capitalist kind of thread that runs through the U.S. constitutional structure that you referred to, they run up not just against the corporation, they run up against their own structure of law first. And that's proving to be at least the elements of a very combustible type of activism where communities think that they should be able to say no to these things and are now beginning to question the very legal doctrines that prevent them from saying no in the first place.
And if we look at the Constitution was initially a very undemocratic doctrine. I mean, it still to this day doesn't guarantee the right of people to vote. That's done through a variety of case laws, decisions, interpretations of later amendments. You know, maybe 3 to 5% of the population could vote initially, but many people in the United States have been taught or believe that we were set up to be a democracy. You assert that sustainability is illegal under the current system of law. How is that?
Yeah, I think it still comes as a shock to people to hear that the U.S. Constitution is not necessarily a democratic instrument. Justice Ginsburg, the U.S. Supreme Court, was in Egypt a little while ago, and the reporters asked her, they said, well, Justice Ginsburg, if you were in a new country writing a new constitution, which constitution would you use? And she said, certainly not the United States Constitution. And I think that came as a shock to a lot of people that here was a Supreme Court justice saying that the U.S. Constitution wasn't necessarily democratic. And while the talk has been, over the last 10 years especially, by historians and academics and activists and some within the judiciary, saying that the Constitution is not necessarily a democratic instrument, I think there's still a very small number of people actually saying that the U.S. Constitution was never intended to be a democratic instrument, which is two different things. And unfortunately, the founding fathers, the folks that many people hold walk sacred ground and were the best, brightest people that ever lived and grew up in the United States, those folks in the 1780s basically saw the need for a U.S. Constitution, a federal plan of governance, a source code or DNA that actually bolstered commerce. So they looked across the landscape and saw this endless bounty of natural resources and said to each other, how do we actually maximize our use of those natural resources to become a major world power? And that 1780s plan of governance has really been locked into that commercial protection mode, which when you look very carefully at the body of the U.S. Constitution, we're not talking about the Bill of Rights, we're talking about the U.S. Constitution itself, that property rights and values and commercial rights and values have been elevated to the highest form of protection in the U.S. constitutional structure. So, for example, things like the Commerce Clause, which are embedded into the U.S. Constitution, provide specific, very special protections for commerce, whereas, unfortunately, slaves, of course, are not mentioned in the U.S. Constitution, or labor, or nature, or communities, or those types of things. And so that override is very clear within the U.S. constitutional structure, and it's these people and communities who run up against it when they take on these corporate projects.
Protection of contracts, though, is in that Constitution, is it not?
Absolutely. Contracts Clause, right along with the Commerce Clause, is a huge piece of what's become this corporate jurisprudence in the United States. People don't recognize this or understand it, I think, in many ways. But corporations, when they receive their charter from state government, that the U.S. Supreme Court, as far back as 1819, has declared that those charters are contracts under the law. And a lot of people say, well, so what? Corporate charters are contracts. Well, they're protected by the Contracts Clause of the U.S. Constitution, which means that states and local governments can't interfere with that corporate charter or the powers given under it. And so in many ways, when these projects come into your communities, the corporation putting it in has more rights than the people in the community in which they're trying to put these projects in.
An argument, though, there was tremendous fear of these corporations in the beginning, even some of the framers, because of their experience with the corporations from the English crown, and you used to be able to pursue them for being ultra-virus, and that it's evolved that there's virtually no restriction. I know here in Ohio, we followed New Jersey, is that you don't even have to say the name and purpose of the corporation. It's assumed to be for any lawful purpose. So the way to contain these corporations, the limited way, we used to be worried about how much money they had and what they were up to. All of those seem to have been swept aside, have they not?
Yeah, they've been peeled back over the last 150 years in different places, and you're absolutely right. The fact is that in the early days of the Republic, you know, early 1800s, you had, as commonplace in many states, very firm restrictions on corporate operations. So, for example, corporations could only exist for 10 or 15 years in certain places and then had to have their charter renewed by the legislature. And perhaps most importantly, you know, to get a corporate charter, it was not just a payment of a fee and submission of paperwork to the state. It was actually a legislative act. You had to get a bill passed to actually get a corporate charter. And so there was fairly tight control exercised over corporations during that period of time. And in fact, in addition to that, corporations had to exist in the public interest. So, you know, their very reason for being in many ways was to be a public entity, a different understanding than what we have today, in which corporations are generally treated as private entities. But, you know, over the past 150 years, not only has the U.S. Supreme Court bestowed certain rights and powers on the corporate form, but in addition, as you just said, the stripping away has occurred. So every obstacle that has been met by this growing body of wealth and commerce in the corporate form has actually begun to strip away what was once some public protections against corporate activities in those states, almost a race to the bottom, as folks have called it, but a stripping away of those protections and less to protect us at the local level.
And Tish O'Dell, you know this firsthand, do you not? I associate you with the struggles in Broadview Heights, and you want to tell the listeners about that?
Sure. Back in 2012, the people of Broadview Heights circulated a petition to put a law on the ballot, a community bill of rights, to protect themselves from more drilling that was going on in the city.
So there was actual drilling in the municipality?
Correct. We had 90 wells in a 13-square-mile city radius.
And is that why people move there?
No, that's not why they move there. It's a residential suburb of Cleveland, all residential, no industry. And that's when, you know, enough is enough.
But the zoning laws protected you, right?
No, wrong. Wrong, Bob.
I mean, that's what people think, right?
That's what they think,
You talk to people, and it's like, well, you know, right. Just zone them out of existence. You couldn't do that?
No, and we, of course, went to our local officials first and said, you know, 90 is enough. We don't want 91 or 92. And they said, there's nothing we can do. The state has control. So they were preempted by the state with the State Oil and Gas Act mm-hmm. in 2004. And so we didn't know, you know, what else to do. We went to our state reps, and, of course, they said, well, you know, we have jobs coming in, and it's good for the economy. So they weren't going to take any action to protect us. So we took our own action to protect ourselves and wrote and passed a community bill of rights in 2012. 67% of the people passed it, said no more, no mm-hmm. more wells in Broadview Heights.
And what happened?
2014, two drilling companies came in and sued the city and said they have the right to drill because they had a state-issued permit. And that gave them the right to drill in our city. So it's all currently in litigation. The city defended it based on, you know, the Municipal Corporation's Home Rule Authority, which we knew would not be a good defense, and lost. The citizens tried to intervene in the lawsuit, and the judge said we had no standing. So the citizens who passed it had no standing to intervene because the city would defend us. And so we then filed a class action lawsuit against the state of Ohio, the governor, the Oil and Gas Association, and the drillers.
Tom, were there no state laws that would apply here?
Well, there's no state laws. I mean, basically what you're looking at is when the lawsuit came in the door against Broadview Heights, and the complaint against Broadview Heights is exactly the same format as the lawsuits brought against Mora County, New Mexico, or against the city of Lafayette, Colorado. Or against, Blaine Township in the western part of Pennsylvania, or Grant Township in the central part of Pennsylvania. All these communities who are trying to stop hydrocarbon extraction or frack wells or fracking wastewater injection wells. The lawsuit that comes in the door has two claims. One is preemption, which says you can't do this because the state has said we have exclusive regulatory power over oil and gas operations, for example, in the state of Ohio. But then the second claim, of course, in these cases is that you're violating the corporation's constitutional rights. And, of course, corporations have had constitutional rights for 150 years in this country. They have the same rights as persons for the most part, and they use those rights as persons and other rights like the Commerce Clause in the Constitution to sue these municipalities. And what's fascinating, it's horrifying in some ways, about what Tish just mentioned is that the people themselves who have passed these laws, the municipal corporations don't like them because it puts them on a hook to get sued for these issues. But the people themselves can't even get into the lawsuit that's brought by the corporation because it's deemed that they're adequately represented by the municipal corporation, when in reality the municipal corporation is looking out for its own interests, which generally are its own financial liability and those types of things. So, you know, we have a perfectly built system here in the United States that divests people within their own communities from having any kind of voice, having any kind of control over things like oil and gas operations that are planned for their community.
Tish, couldn't you go to the county prosecutor? Did you go? I mean, aren't these people violating some laws?
Well, we think they're violating our rights. We have the right to clean air and the right to clean water, our environment. I mean, you know, how long do we have to...
So you say that's a basic constitutional right.
Correct. We have the right to life, right? And if they're poisoning our water and our air, they're interfering with our right to life. So, yeah, I mean, and the basic thing about democracy, that's what I learned along the way. I thought, too, we had a democracy here, and the majority rules. Well, we had 67% of the people vote for this, and I learned that meant nothing as far as our state is concerned.
Well, Tom, they would have certain rights if it was a strip club, would they not, in terms of zoning? But you're saying the mining interest, the oil and gas interest, basically can't be stopped by local, well-established zoning laws? And why can't I go to the county prosecutor if these people are poisoning me?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what we've learned over the years, which is, you know, zoning ordinances allow you to make the facility perhaps a little bit better or to zone it in out of a residential area, for example. But the overall legal point here is that your municipality has to take it. Your municipality has to receive it because, you know, under the U.S. system law, you can't ban a use that's been permitted by the state or federal government. And so it becomes not only a preemption issue, but again, a corporate constitutional rights issue. I wish prosecutors would take this kind of stuff up, but unfortunately, it's not, you know, the bad stuff in our system is not necessarily the illegal stuff. The bad stuff in our system is what's been legalized. And corporate constitutional rights have been legalized. So corporate power has been legalized within that system of law. You know, it's funny, the oil and gas interests in Pennsylvania have taken to calling community groups opposing their projects terrorists within their communities. But we have to ask ourselves who the real terrorists are. I mean, in some ways, you want to talk about domestic terrorists, it's the corporations themselves. And it's the law firms that the corporations hire to actually come in to terrorize the residents with lawsuits and threats and all those kinds of things. And so, you know, that's the situation that we find ourselves in as communities divested of any authority whatsoever to really say no to these projects coming in.
You're listening to Community Radio, WCRS 98.3, 102.1. Tish, were you terrorized? Did you see your community as being terrorized by these interests?
Well, sure we did. And, you know, in our local electeds, both our city law director and our mayor and most of our council, you know, were against us. They didn't support us. They were afraid of, you know, we kept getting the threats of being sued. You know, you're going to get the city sued. We could go bankrupt, you know, all these threats. When we're saying, what are you talking about? We're the ones that are breathing toxic air. We're the ones that, you know, are feeling the effects of this. And yet that was what the, you know, they didn't support this in any way. So, yeah, I felt terrorized.
Did you take any action that was questionable? Did you do
something? Passing the Community Bill of Rights was questionable. No one wanted us to do that. No one thought we could do it.
Was that a terrorist act?
I don't feel like it was a terrorist act.
Were you declaring war on the oil and gas interest who had a constitutional and right under state and federal law?
Well, it's interesting. They feel like that because they even in our local paper published, you know, some quotes that were in there. And I know the one president of the one drilling company said, these people are interfering with our right to drill and make a profit in Broadview Heights. All we want to do is do our project and leave. And they came right out and said it in the paper. They were so blatant about it.
All right. And Tom, your argument is that we have to change the DNA of the system currently operating in the U.S. Should people be afraid of that type of language?
Well, if they're afraid of that, they were probably afraid of the abolitionists in the 1840s and the suffragists in the 1870s and the other people's movements that we had in the United States, like the populist farmers of the late 1800s or the civil rights movement even. I mean, what we're talking about is that individual site fights over these corporate projects are pretty much meaningless because those individual site fights, you know, individual communities, individual sites, individual projects, fighting them through the regulatory system, like appealing permits or begging the corporation to change their project or to reroute the pipeline, that all those things are just nibbling around the edges, that in essence we have a constitutional structure in the United States that places certain rights and values over our rights and values within our communities. After all, if we can't say no to a frack job coming into the community, we can't say yes to clean air and clean water. If we can't say no to Walmart and Costco, we can't say yes to vibrant downtowns. There's a real opportunity cost. When you can't say no to something coming in, it automatically supplants your sustainable vision for your community in itself. So I think the question we really have to ask ourselves is, do we have a democracy operating here? And do we live in a democracy? And the answer from these communities has been a resounding no, because they can't even control the fate of their own communities over the next 20, 40, or 60 years. To change that means a people's movement of sorts that hasn't been seen in the United States for the last 100 years in many ways, which is based on driving structural change into the state and federal constitutions. And I think that takes 10,000 communities. Currently, right now, we have 200 communities in 10 states that have done what Tish did in Broadview Heights. So folks moving forward to say, not only are we going to say no to this project, but we're going to say no to corporate rights, and we're going to say no to state preemption, and we're going to say no to these doctrines that would normally kick in to prevent us from passing these kinds of laws. But make no doubt about it, these local laws are not really laws at all. They're new constitutions. They're a blueprint of a new constitutional structure, which eventually has to supplant the state and federal constitutional structure that we have. Otherwise, we better get used to living on our knees, because that's what we've done for the past 50 years when these corporations have come in to exploit our communities.
So, Tish, the Ohio Community Bill of Rights, is this exactly what Tom is talking about? You're coming in claiming that people at the local level have a constitutional right to clean air and clean water.
Yeah, basically what we've done is we formed a network in 2013, the Ohio Community Rights Network, and there's currently 13 counties from around the state of Ohio that have joined the network. So they have representatives, people from those counties that sit on the board and run the network. Columbus has one here with Carolyn Harding is in Columbus. She's the Franklin County board member. And what we're basically doing is working together to propose a state constitutional amendment to our state of Ohio Constitution that would guarantee the right of people to local self-government.
And the notion is, as Tom was delineating, is that these things pop up. It's like whack-a-mole. You spend all your time going after one after another, 90 different sites. The approach is it's just easier to say you have no right to do this here.
Right, correct. It's that the people have more rights than the corporations. That's the other part of the constitutional amendment. So that in the future, what it does is it legalizes all these individual community bills of rights where the people in the communities can pass these and they won't be, deemed illegal by our system.
Now, Tom, the position of your organization, the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, is that you can turn the resources of the aggressor, by that I mean whatever the corporation is, whether it's hog farms or 20 million chickens at a chicken farm or the fracking people, turn their resources against them. It also seemed like this point was made yesterday, the state of Ohio moved very quickly after a massive disaster with the chicken farm, which killed virtually everything in the Licking River, for miles and miles. This looks like what you're trying to do is, of course, to be more proactive.
Yeah, and in some ways we talk about legal jujitsu, which is that we really have no power at all under the current system. So we, the people...
What do you mean by that? If I'm a local person, you're telling me the current system really doesn't give me any power?
Yeah, we've been schnookered under the current system, whereas our municipal corporations have some slight degree of power to do things like nuisance ordinances and pass zoning laws and those types of things, that the people within the community really aren't recognized at all. In some ways, we're just squatters in our own municipalities because the law doesn't recognize us as having much power at all. So we need to plug into another power source. And, of course, the corporate boys have all the power in the world. So in some ways, when you pass a law like Broadview Heights did and you actually draw the challenge, the corporation has to come in the door and actually argue that they do have those constitutional rights and that they do have more rights than the community in which they do business. My favorite part of these legal briefs, reading through them, whether it's the private corporations or the attorney generals of these various states that we've challenged, one of their argument headings will be, the people of Broadview Heights have no right to local self-government. They'll actually put that into their briefs as their lead argument. And I think instead of arguing over parts per million or arguing about, water resource plans and all this other stuff that we get dragged into through the regulatory and permit system, we have to start talking about the basic underlying concept here, which is that structurally that our rights have been subordinated to corporate rights. And corporations, under the structure of law, of course, are property. They can be bought and sold, just like our refrigerators or our cars or our other pieces of property. Yet, under the system of law, they've successfully gamed it to be able to secure for themselves the constitutional rights of persons, and in doing so have, in essence, elevated the rights of that property over the rights of people in the community. So the system has done a very good job of systematically divesting us of any authority at all to control what happens in our own communities. For that to change, there has to be a real people's movement that does something that folks haven't really done in the past 100 years, which is to change this fundamental structure of law, which is illegitimate.
Well, here's a provocative subhead. Fomenting state constitutional change through collective municipal legislative civil disobedience. Is that what you're advocating, Tish O'Dell?
Why don't you take that?
I think it's a mouthful, but that's exactly what this work is about because it's not going to happen by making you know, by continuing to beg and plead regulators or state legislators to do the job, this change has to be forced. So just like the abolitionists in the 1840s couldn't turn to the U.S. Constitution because the U.S. Constitution didn't recognize African Americans as people under the law, and in fact, it validated slavery. Or the suffragists in the 1880s who looked at the system of law and didn't see women being recognized as persons under that structure of law, that they had to move outside of that structure to do something different, which was to build a movement that didn't rely on the U.S. Constitution. It relied on the Declaration of Independence and the guarantees from the American Revolution. I think we're at a similar time. I mean, just to show you how horrific it is, you know, corporations became persons in 1886. Women in this country didn't become persons even for suffrage purposes until 1920. So corporations became persons before women became persons in the United States. And so the power of property and commerce, this concept of endless production of more stuff that's protected by the U.S. constitutional structure is all around us. It just happens to be camouflaged, and we don't run into it until we actually have to stop something from coming into our particular community.
One of the things you talked about last night was Dillon's Law, and that, in my mind, 1924, Native Americans get the right to vote. Prior to that, thought to be almost orphans of the state under the federal government. What you seem to outline, and what Tish and her neighbors and friends were suffering under, appears to be that form of essentially no rights. You know, you're a child.
Yes, and in fact, I think the fine point to that was really put on for me during one of our two-day trainings. We call them democracy schools, where we trace the arc of the U.S. Constitution and why we're in the position that we're in. We did a democracy school at the Pine Ridge Reservation for the tribe a number of years ago, and we had a bunch of white people in the room from the community, and we had a bunch of indigenous folks in the room from the reservation. And the white people were having a hard, really hard time trying to understand why the system of law does not benefit them. In other words, that's how they can't use it. And one of the indigenous people, you know, a woman put up her hand and she said, wow, these, you know, wringing their hands trying to figure this stuff out. She said, at least we know we live on a reservation. That in some ways our municipalities are reservations, you know, slaves by any other name kind of thing, where we're harnessed into a certain form of production, whether or not we want to be or not. And so I think being in that position and actually understanding how the structure of law disempowers us, I think is essential to giving birth to a people's movement that's eventually going to clear the field and restore or reclaim or claim for the first time, you can pick your verb, about what this system should be. Because I think right now, getting to a place where we have economic and environmental sustainability is impossible when we're told to play within a box, which is whose sides are defined by these different doctrines, including corporate power and corporate rights.
Tish O'Dell, do you want to make an invitation to the readers, let them know how they can contact you, how they can join your group? And you are from the Reservation of Broadville Heights, are you not?
Yes, I am. Sometimes I refer to it. I now in presentations, I said I'm from the oil and gas colony of Broadview Heights.
So in a sense, though, you have been colonized, or at least neocolonialism, right? You really don't control your economic resources. Some foreign entity, and literally it could be out of state, which would make it a foreign corporation, not a state of Ohio corporation, owns your resources.
Exactly. That's exactly what we live in. So it's true. We have been colonized. And that's something that people need to realize and they need to say. And they need to admit that we live in a corporate state. You know, just like people lived in a slave state and women lived in a patriarchal state and a racist state in the 50s and 60s. We live in a corporate state. And we're the ones who have to change that. The corporations aren't going to change it, and our government's not going to change it. We have to change it.
How would our listeners get a hold of you or find out information on the Ohio Communities Bill of Rights Network?
Right. We have a website, www.ohiocrn.org, and then they can also contact me at tish@celdef.org, which is celdf.org.
And Carolyn Harding from Franklin County in the background there, she's the contact. Is there a contact number for Franklin County as well?
Yes, our email is columbusbillofrights@gmail.com. That's our email. And then our website is columbusbillofrights.org.
All right. And Tom, any last words?
No, just thanks for having us on the show. And Ohio is basically on fire with folks doing this community Bill of Rights approach to organizing. And I think in the scheme of things, the seven other states that we're working in currently, Ohio is at the top of the list in some ways, and people unwilling to take this stuff lying down and are beginning to fight for their own Bill of Rights within their local communities.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks, Tish. Thanks, Carolyn. And this is Bob Trakis bringing you the other side of the news.